Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. The federal tax and spending bill signed last week by President Trump will blow a $3 billion hole in the New York State budget. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
State Budget Director Blake Washington says the so-called Big Beautiful Bill will cut billions of dollars from the state's Medicaid program starting next year. The program is jointly funded by the state and federal governments. It provides health care to low-income and disabled people. Washington says hospitals will also take a hit.
The word that comes to mind is just destabilization. It is a system-wide impact to the provider network.
Washington says Governor Kathy Hochul will talk with Democrats who control the state legislature about how to respond. Republicans in Congress say the bill lowers taxes and cuts down on Medicaid waste, fraud, and abuse. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
While the new budget bill signed into law by President Trump includes cuts to Medicaid, disabled activists say what worries them most is what we don't know yet about its impacts. The New York Public News Network's Emily Watkins shares why disabled New Yorkers are more worried for the state-specific cuts that could come their way.
I have learned that it's not just one thing. It's basically, it helps me with my entire life.
That's 35-year-old Hannah Brecker talking about Medicaid. And she's right. Medicaid covers a lot and isn't just health insurance. Brecker shared that when doctors discovered issues with her ankles, she could get treatment to walk better. When she was diagnosed with autism.
I was diagnosed with autism in 2008 when I was 18 years old. I got therapy to be able to speak and to be able to do a lot of things. So Medicaid has really been there for me.
But one aspect of Medicaid that doesn't get talked about as much is home and community-based services, or HCBS. These programs vary state by state, but usually focus on providing supports that allow people to stay in their communities. Brecker is able to access additional support, including a care coordinator, through this program. But that's not all HCBS covers.
I use Medicaid for AIDS service. It helps me to do daily living. Like, for example, I get help, and I'm not afraid to say any of this, bathing. I get help with food preparation. I also get help with dressing. Medicaid also pays for probably, I can't say all of it because I'm not sure, but I think it pays for all, if not a significant portion, of my wheelchair.
Mike Rogers is another self-advocate who relies on home and community-based services in New York.
What scares me the most is, you know, not knowing what fully is going to be affected and what does that mean down the road.
While many are concerned about the direct cuts the One Big Beautiful Bill Act or the federal budget makes to Medicaid, advocates worry about how the states will make up for these cuts. The nonpartisan policy institute, Center for American Progress, has pointed out that previously, when federal funds to states for Medicaid have been lost, states have attempted to make up that lost funding by cutting programs. Those cuts have included HCBS programs, dental programs, and even speech therapy for adults, like what Brecker received.
I feel like they want us to reopen institutions and put us away again when we just want to be out in the community. We want to be able to live our lives the way we need to.
Advocates worry that the loss of any of these benefits could impact disabled people being able to live independently rather than in an institution or hospital. Brecker says that as someone with a learning disability, she worries about losing her HCBS-funded care coordinator, who provides her the information she needs to make important decisions.
I also have a learning disability, so I can be perceived as, you know, not a know-it-all, but more of a, like, being, you know, if somebody was to harm me, I would have never known if that would happen. But my care coordination, what they would do is they would guide me to where I need to go and give me information. The thing is that with care coordination for us, it's definitely our lifeline.
Both Brecker and Rogers say that while the cuts the federal spending plan makes are concerning, they worry about what we don't yet know. How states will decide to cope with these cuts, and if that will include sacrificing vital programs within HCBS.
We cannot lose these things, or we lose our freedoms.
I'm Emily Watkins for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gastina. This week, I sat down with Times Union Capitol Bureau reporter Dan Clark, who's also the author of Capitol Confidential. We spoke about the coming burden of federal cuts to New York State.
These cuts from this bill are billions and billions of dollars. And if the state is going to fill that gap from the federal government, that money has to come from somewhere. So what the governor has said and what lawmakers have said is that they can't backfill that money. It's so much that they would have to raise taxes across the board to make up that gap, and that's not something that they want to do. Now, if they can soften the blow, that's another story, and we don't know how they would be able to do that. In areas like food stamps, SNAP, there is a possibility that state funding could help bridge that gap, but not cover it completely. Same thing with these Medicaid cuts. And a lot of the Medicaid cuts come from eligibility changes. So it's not necessarily something that the state can hone in on anyway. The impact for a lot of people is just going to be devastating. And I think that there's a sense in the legislature and for the governor that there's not much that they can do about it. So what I've seen and what I predict will happen is that they're probably going to use this politically for next year's elections.
Yeah, it's going to be a hammer, right?
Absolutely.
They're going to say, they did this to you, that's the Republicans, blame them. So you're going to have that blame game. Unfortunately, too, when states go bad, sometimes it's the leader of the state that gets blamed along with the rest. So you've
right.
got Governor Hochul there looking at her potential prospects, and she's got people lining up to challenge her based on where she stands in the polls. So you really are going to see the political gamesmanship ratcheting up as we begin to see these cuts play out.
And you already have, really. I mean, the governor has been trying to pressure the Republican members of Congress from New York for months now to avoid this exact situation of putting the state in a scenario where we have these billions of dollars in gaps for health care, for education, all the things that the federal government supports. You know, not everything is being cut, but there are certainly restrictions in a lot of areas that the state just isn't prepared to do anything about. And I think you're exactly right that this is really useful ammunition for the governor in a sense that because there's not much the state can do to fill these gaps and to help people get through this, her only option really is to use it to campaign for Democrats in Congress to flip the majority there and maybe undo some of this. Of course, with President Trump in the White House, that probably wouldn't happen. But that's something that she can do to also say, look at me, I'm doing the right thing. Give me another term in office.
Yeah. And so far, she's well ahead of her competitors in the latest Siena poll.
Oh, yeah.
However, she does have this very strange and interesting, from a journalistic perspective, challenge coming from her lieutenant governor of all people, Antonio Delgado, the former congressman who decided not to run for re-election in was the 19th district.
Mm-hmm.
And then he jumped into the Hochul administration as lieutenant governor. And just decides, I don't want to play lieutenant governor for you anymore. They have this public spat, and now he's challenging her for her own office.
I think that he thought when he was becoming lieutenant governor that he was getting into something that wasn't what it turned out to be. I think that he thought when he came in that this was going to be a collaborative relationship with Governor Hochul to really enact some major changes that he wanted to see on the state level. Instead, like how Andrew Cuomo did to Kathy Hochul, Kathy Hochul decided that Antonio Delgado was going to kind of do these ribbon-cutting roles and these kind of ceremonial things that don't necessarily enact real change. And we now know, after he's announced his campaign for governor, looking at his issue areas, that he is further to the left than Hochul. He's calling for raising taxes on the wealthy and corporations, something that Governor Hochul has said that she will not do while she's in office. So it's going to be a really interesting test for the Democratic Party and for the electorate in general as to, you know, are they looking for a centrist Democrat to fill this office? Or does the state statewide, in terms of Democrats, do they want to see the party shift a little bit further to the left? And I think that'll be fascinating to watch next year.
Oh, it's so fascinating, because by saying that, you're referencing the New York City primary and what we've seen with Zohran Mamdani, and the fact that you can see this push me, pull you fight going on in the Democratic Party, that the centrists always seem to win, and yet they're not making the arguments that resonate with people.
That's exactly it. I mean, one thing that people miss in terms of they don't see in Donald Trump is that a big reason why his message went so far is because it was a clear populist message. Him saying, I'm going to help you out with your affordability issues. Antonio Delgado is pitching the same thing in his campaign for governor. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Bernie Sanders say the same thing. They want to tell low-income people that they don't have to be low-income anymore, that we can do things as a society to lift them up in a sense of a rising tide lifts all ships. And I think nowadays in politics, it's less so that your positions pick the person that you are going to support. It's more you pick the person and that determines your positions on a lot of things. So you have a lot of people who turn to these big names and then kind of fall in line with everything that they believe as well. When at the end of the day, what they really just want is that populist message of affordability, lowering the cost of living, and making sure that people don't fall behind when they don't have to.
That's Times Union Capital Bureau reporter Dan Clark. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Now that it has been signed into law, healthcare providers are assessing the potential impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act on hospitals in New York State. As the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports, the bill has rural hospitals bracing for impact.
Walking around Ellenville Regional Hospital, you get a sense of a business trying to make do with what it has. The 25-bed teaching hospital is in a building that dates to the 1960s, in a rural area of Ulster County by the Catskill Mountains. Support Services Director John Gavaris gives me a tour of how it's changed over the years. In 2021, they reconfigured the ER to make more isolation space during the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2019, they took down walls to create more gym space in the physical therapy unit. In around 2007, they spent $70,000 to expand four hospital rooms.
So it was $70,000 just for the four rooms?
$70,000 for one room.
For one room?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Four.
Okay.
Yeah. We had to redo plumbing. We had to cut a trench. We had to put a new sewer line outside. It was quite a project.
It turns out renovating healthcare spaces is very expensive, especially when you're behind on roughly 50 years of building code. Hospital President Stephen Kelly says fully renovating Ellenville would cost about the same as building a new hospital. So that's what they're trying to do next door in the next 5 years, to the tune of about $83 million.
You know, we have big problems here. We need new boilers, we need new air conditioning, we need big items that require major, major renovations.
Kelly says they've raised about half of that money so far, and he's hopeful New York State will plug part of the gap. All of this comes as industry leaders warn of potential economic headwinds as a result of the Big Beautiful Bill. The budget cuts federal Medicaid spending in ways that could cause up to 1.5 million New Yorkers to lose their coverage, according to Governor Kathy Hochul. But hospital emergency rooms can't turn away patients just because they don't have insurance. They will continue to care for people, just without getting paid. How this will impact Ellenville's budget, Kelly says it's too soon to tell. He says they're in a good spot financially, but currently Medicaid patients account for roughly a third of their business.
This really, I think there may be other providers that will be impacted, but it'll be very disproportionately shouldered by hospitals. That's really a cut to hospitals.
The Big Beautiful Bill cuts more than $1 trillion in federal healthcare spending over the next decade to extend and expand President Trump's tax cuts from 2017. It does this in part by establishing work requirements on able-bodied Medicaid recipients that will undoubtedly kick some people off the program. Christina Bott, Senior Vice President of Federal Policy at the Healthcare Association of New York State, says the bill also caps provider taxes used to fund the state's share of Medicaid and cuts funding for New York's Essential Plan. She says the impact on the overall healthcare system will be, quote, devastating.
Based on the numbers that we see in the legislation and now law, we are anticipating upwards of 63,000 jobs lost throughout the state.
Much of the Big Beautiful Bill doesn't take effect until at least 2026, but some hospitals in the Hudson Valley are already making cuts. Last month, Garnet Health Medical Center in Middletown laid off 42 employees and dropped 2 outpatient services. The hospital also downgraded its trauma center from level 2 to level 3, meaning it will increasingly transfer patients with serious injuries to other facilities. CEO Jerry Dunleavy cited, quote, anticipated federal cuts to the Medicaid program in the decision. Bott says it's likely more hospitals will take their lead.
We will probably see a lot of construction projects or, you know, capital improvement projects get pushed aside as hospitals are trying to just fortify and, you know, get prepared for this tremendous avalanche that's going to be coming towards us.
After decades, Ellenville Regional Hospital has become a big part of its community. For starters, the next closest hospitals are at least 30 minutes away. It also offers free exercise classes, overdose prevention programs, and even senior housing across the street. Guevara says he worries federal cuts could put a damper on its construction plans.
Our model of being able to do this is us taking out a loan of $25 million and being able to pay that back on the revenues that we make from seeing patients. And if our revenues drop, that could impact our ability to repay a loan, and it's a concern.
Kelly is a little more optimistic.
If we are able to get funding from the state, I still think the model will work.
Reporting from Ellenville, I'm Jesse King.
Residents of Voorheesville have been trying to create quiet zones at 2 railroad intersections in the village for more than a decade. Those efforts may soon succeed. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor explains.
In the Albany County Village, residents often wait beside the tracks on South Main Street for a chance to see a train pass by. But for some residents, like Stephen Schreiber, the rattling of trains and blast of their horns are a nuisance.
The noise of the trains is obvious just to anyone who lives here, and particularly at nighttime.
More than a decade ago, Schreiber created a group consisting of residents who advocate for a quiet zone, an area of railroad intersections where a conductor is not required to sound the train's horn. As it stands, a conductor must sound the train's horn each time they pass through the village on the CSX-owned tracks. Voorheesville Mayor Richard Strout says that's because the intersection only has partial gates instead of gates that stretch entirely across the road to prevent oncoming traffic from crossing the tracks as a train passes.
They have a couple of whistle blows at that crossing and then a couple here. If that happens 40 times a day, day and night, that's the issue that people are concerned about. Not everybody, but the people who have kind of been driving this for the past 13 years.
But if the village can make safety changes to the intersection, the noisy whistles would no longer be necessary.
What we're proposing is to put what they call a 4-quadrant gate system in. So that's where a gate would come down on the travel lane and the other oncoming lane. So on both sides of the tracks, so that the theory is that cars can't go around it, and it improves the safety of the intersection. So in that case, the trains, the conductors don't have to blow their horns.
Schreiber says efforts to attain a quiet zone have been arduous, bogged down in back and forth about funding disbursements, with bureaucratic processes among the state, village, and county prolonging the process.
And actually, by 2017, we had full funding for the quiet zone. And we thought we were in pretty good shape to go at that point, but then the state raised some questions about the type of project it was and whether funding could be released for this type of project without certain preconditions.
There are $420,000 in grants for the project currently under review by the Dormitory Authority of the State of New York. But the latest holdup, Strout says, are disagreements over maintenance fees.
Essentially, CSX said, well, we want you to be responsible for the cost of maintaining these gates.
Strout says CSX originally said the cost of maintaining the gates would be $50,000.
We've been going back and forth for the better part of, well, it's going on 9 months to a year regarding the maintenance agreement, and we've made a lot of progress with them.
He says the maintenance fees cost was eventually brought down to $20,000, but contract terms between the county, village, and railroad company have yet to be finalized. CSX did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Director of Operations for Albany County, Michael Lally, says the county is currently discussing how to share that expense with the village. He says the agreement on liability is also holding up the project.
The liability was basically, if anything bad happens at the intersection, it's going to fall upon the county. And that was just a huge burden for us to take on.
Lally says there is a good chance that the county and CSX can reach a deal as soon as next week.
We've come to an agreement on the terms of the contract, specifically the maintenance fees and the liability. But we just need to clarify a couple very small details, like what type of streetlights they want us to use.
As for Schreiber, he says the goalposts keep moving.
And to say we're frustrated is to put it mildly, but that's the story.
Reporting from Voorheesville, I'm Jesse Taylor.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Two trees planted this week signify the Albany County town of Guilderland's deep historical roots as celebrations marking the 250th anniversary of the start of the American Revolution begin. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has more.
Two golden russet apple trees are the beginning of a new orchard on a plot of land near the town's community gardens in Altamont. Guilderland Town Supervisor Peter Barber says the reintroduction of legacy apple trees serves as a reminder that produce from local farms was the breadbasket for soldiers during the Revolutionary War. On August 11, 1777, the Battle of Normanskill was fought nearby along what is now Route 146.
The Battle of the Normanskill is actually known by many people, but very people know what actually was happening in the community itself, whether it was the farms or the merchants and whatnot. And this is basically a small part to really recognize that basically produce and basically grains and other items, food, was so essential to the ultimate victory at Saratoga. But also here, meanwhile, while the soldiers are all fighting, you've got families, you've got young children, mothers, wives and whatnot are tending to the farm and really feeding this army. And so this is to show that these heritage events like this, which show apples in this case, existed back at the time of the American Revolution.
Barber says the chosen location, protected from weather, is ideal for the tree's survival and reflects colonial farming practices. Local author, environmentalist, filmmaker, historian, professor, and archaeologist Don Rittner chairs the town's 250th American Revolution Committee. He sees the planting of heritage apple trees as a way to connect the community with its historical roots and to educate future generations.
The Dutch, of course, had apples here in the 17th century. That was one of the first things in the Hudson Valley planted by the Dutch. So they weren't unknown, but there were thousands of varieties of apples. And, you know, if you can go to a store and get maybe two or three different ones, you'd be lucky, right? At one time, there were thousands of them. I'm hoping to get 100. I mean, I don't know if I'd be alive long enough, but the goal is to get as many heritage New York apple trees as possible and make this, put events around us about the Guilderland's history. I mean, our history, the town of Guilderland history, in terms of the Revolution, many of the farmers not only fought in the war, but they also supplied foodstuffs to the war effort.
Barber and Rittner planted one tree apiece. Over the next 7 years, Gilderland officials intend to honor the role the town played throughout the duration of the American Revolution. Plans include establishing a full orchard at the site to showcase the breadth of the region's farming and agricultural history, and a reenactment of the Battle of Normanskill. Rittner expects a boost to local tourism.
Heritage tourists, they spend $600 more than the average tourist. They stay an extra day. They're more educated. Many of them have masters. So heritage tourism is a real economic shot. We're in the oldest continually settled area in America, Albany. There's been Europeans here since 1614. And almost any famous American historical event, I could show you somebody from the Capital District that took part in it. So this is the birthplace of American democracy.
Once the apple trees have grown and fruit turned ripe, Barber and Rittner say the town will create annual events around the orchard, including making cider, apple picking, and children's activities.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2528. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.